Volunteers. It's my pleasure to introduce Steph Cizecek, who is a new faculty member at the University of Ottawa and also runs the group called APRICOT. I'll let her explain what that acronym means. And she's going to tell us today about representing quantum states with spiking neural networks. Take it away, Steph.
Thanks, Roger. Is it on? Yeah, it's
perfect.
Working. Nice. Yeah, thanks a lot for the introduction, and thanks also a lot for the invitation. It's always a great pleasure to be here and talk about my research. And yeah, since we had heard a lot about artificial neural networks yesterday, I decided to talk about a kind of related but slightly different topic, which are spiking neural networks. And I will show you that also with these networks, we can represent quantum states. And so as an introduction, what are spiking neural networks? Why are we interested in them? So we all know about artificial neural networks. As the name suggests, they were initially inspired by biological brains. But over the time, they have evolved pretty far away from the biological brains because they have been developed with the motivation to optimize their performance on our conventional computers. Now you can already see, usually in our artificial neural networks, we have this layered structure. And you can imagine that in your biological brain, you don't really have this layered structure, but you have more like a randomly connected network of neurons. And well, it's good that we have this development further away from the biological network, because only due to this, we are now able to use our artificial neural networks, and that's why they are so powerful. But at the same time, and Juan has discussed this yesterday in great detail, we lose a lot of benefits of the biological brains. So if we think about our artificial neural networks, they usually run on huge machines, which consume tons of energy. If we think about our biological brain, well, our brain is pretty small. So we have like 86 billion neurons in the brain. And you can compare this size to the machines where you implement your artificial neurons on. So it's way smaller. It consumes way less energy. And it's also extremely fast if you compare it to artificial neural networks. And so people were now thinking about kind of getting these benefits back into our machine learning applications. And this is where people started introducing spiking neural networks. And so these spiking neural networks, they are really inspired by the biological brain, meaning they try to emulate the behavior of biological neurons. And with this, people try to get back these nice properties of a fast, energy-efficient behavior on small devices. And in order to get this energy efficiency and the small devices, people are running the spiking neural networks on so-called neuromorphic chips, which I will also introduce a little more detail later. But so with these spiking neural networks, we kind of get in between the biological brains and our artificial neural networks so that we still get the nice benefits, but we can apply them for machine learning tasks. And so the reason why I'm so excited about this topic is that we have seen yesterday quite a lot that artificial neural networks find many useful applications in the field of quantum technologies. And so I'm now wondering, can we even use our spiking neural networks in the field of quantum technologies? And can we get any benefits from this? And yeah, I will show you today one example where we probably expect a lot of benefits from using these spiking neural networks to represent quantum states. But before this, let me get into a little more detail about the spiking neurons or biological neurons. So if we start with thinking about our artificial neurons, then they are like discrete in time, meaning our artificial neurons, they take some value if we send in a signal, right? So we propagate a signal through our artificial neural network, and every time our neuron receives a signal, we evaluate it. So at this point in time, it takes a value. But then as soon as we don't send in a signal, nothing is happening. And now you can imagine that in your brain, this is not how it works. So your brain is always doing something. There's no on or off of your neurons. And so we have a continuous behavior in time in biological neurons. And now you can also imagine that if we want to model these biological neurons on a conventional computer, then this means we need to solve for each neuron some differential equation. We need to solve it at every point in time. And these neurons, they are highly connected. So they have strong interactions with each other. And so it's computationally extremely expensive to evaluate these biological neurons or to simulate these biological neurons. And so people came up with a nice approximation, which are these so-called leaky integrated fire neurons. They are a really pretty good approximation of biological neurons. So they are pretty accurate, and they are much easier to simulate. But still, it's extremely expensive on conventional computers. But another benefit of these leaky integrated fire neurons is that they can be modeled on electronic circuits. And this is where people develop these neuromorphic chips. So these are really analog chips, so electronic circuits that simulate the behavior of a human brain. In the picture I'm showing there, this is the BrainScales chip, which is developed at Heidelberg University in Germany. And this is literally developed with the motivation to simulate a human brain. Okay, so this is really pretty close. And so there exist different other groups working on spiking neuromorphic hardware. The most famous ones are Spinnaker from Manchester or Intel's Luigi. And they all, so you can continue this list, there are way more groups working on developing this hardware and also working on exploring spiking neural networks. In the end, these hardwares are pretty efficient. They work already pretty well, even though they are still a little limited. But they are small, they are energy efficient, and also their speed is comparable to biological networks. And so let's take a closer look at the leaky integrated fire neurons. So similarly to our artificial neurons, we can just draw them as a circle, and then we have like an incoming synapse where the neuron receives some signal, and we have an outgoing synapse where it can send out signals to connected neurons. And now the essential point of such a leaky integrated fire neuron is a membrane on which a potential is applied. And I'm plotting this potential. I don't have a mouse. So the blue line up there is our potential, which evolves in time. And the way it evolves in time depends or is influenced by the signals the neuron receives on the incoming synapse. And so other connected neurons can influence the behavior of the membrane potential of our neuron. And once our membrane potential crosses a threshold, as indicated in red here, the neuron spikes, which means first of all, the membrane potential is set to some refractory value for some time. So this is when it reaches this green line down there. And during this time, the membrane potential does not change. So it's fixed no matter what input is coming in. And the neuron can thus not spike again because it cannot cross the threshold. At the same time, the neuron also sends out a signal on the outgoing synapse. So this is the bottom plot. And with this, it influences the membrane potential of connected neurons. And so this way, you can encode information in the time behavior of the spikes, and you can propagate these spikes through the network. And so this is how one neuron works. If we now have like a network of spiking neurons, then this is similar to our artificial neural networks. So we just connect different neurons with each other. They can send signals to each other. And we can weight these connections, and we can also train these weights of the connections. And with this, we can train our network by varying these connections similarly to artificial neural networks. And so now the big question, what can we actually do with our spiking neurons? So they find different applications. The most famous one is classification. So similarly to our artificial neural networks, we can use spiking neural networks to detect animals in images. In this case, if we have, for example, if we look at the MNIST dataset, we would have 10 output neurons, 10 spiking output neurons to classify the number in the image. And then we would train our network such that the classified number or the neuron that represents the classified number spikes first. Okay, so we always say the neuron that represents the class of the image should spike first, so we can encode information in the time-dependent spikes. Now, why would we use spiking neural networks for classification? Well, if we look at images, it's probably not worth it, because even though we have our neuromorphic hardware, it's still way more inefficient than if we just use artificial neural networks. So if we look at images, our artificial neural networks are pretty good at classifying images, and so we don't really need these spiking neurons. But where they are really strong is when we look at time-dependent data. So for example, if we want to classify a video, then since our spiking neurons are just continuously evolving in time, we can classify a video in real time. So we don't need to break it down into different frames, but we can just send in the data, and we have our network reacting to the incoming data, which changes in time in real time. Okay. Another really nice behavior is that we have cyclic connections in the spiking neural networks, which means we kind of have a memory effect. So if our neuron spikes at some point in time, then this just by these cyclic connections, it can also still influence the neuron or itself at some later time. So we have kind of a memory effect. And so we have a natural recurrent behavior in these spiking neural networks. Another nice application is that we can generate data, meaning we can train our network to encode a probability distribution and then generate data from this probability distribution. And this is the application point there that I want to focus on today. So let me get into a little more detail. So the first thing we need in order to use our spiking neural network as a generative neural network is we need some binary interpretation of our neurons. And we can introduce this by just defining our neurons to be in one state when they are refractory, meaning they have just spiked, the potential is fixed, so they cannot spike again. This is one state. And the other state would be if they have not just spiked, so they can just freely evolve and they can spike at any point in time. And then we can read out the neuron configurations at different points in time. So you see this on the right here. So we just read out whether any neuron is refractory or not. And with this, we kind of read out the neuron states. And then by just training our network to encode some probability distribution, we can this way read out samples from this probability distribution. And again, we can train our network to encode a target distribution by just training the connecting weights. Now there's one problem with this, because everything I've told you now is deterministic. So if I give you the initial conditions, then you can tell me exactly which neuron spikes at what point in time. And so it's not really sampling from a probability distribution. And so what we do instead is we add some noise neurons. So we have a bunch of neurons which just randomly spike at some points in time. And with this, we get a stochastic behavior. So we always get a probability that a neuron spikes or not, because we have these noise neurons which just generate some noise effect on the membrane potential. And so with this, we really have a sampling process from a probability distribution if we read out our neuron configurations at different points in time. And now the missing ingredient we now have is the probability distribution that we want to train. So we know that we can sample from some probability distribution underlying our neurons, but if we don't know the distribution, and we have no idea what the distribution actually is, then how can we train our network? And luckily, people have spent quite a lot of time exploring these encoded probability distributions, and they have shown that you can actually approximate restricted Bolzmann machines with these spiking neural networks. And so once we know that we approximate restricted Bolzmann machines, we also know how to train our network because we know the probability distribution underlying the neuron configurations. Okay, so let me get into a little more detail about restricted Bolzmann machines. I think we haven't seen them yet yesterday. So restricted Bolzmann machines are pretty simple networks. So we have two layers. We have visible neurons and we have hidden neurons. They are all binary, so they can take two values, plus one or minus one. And then we have connections between neurons in the different layers. So there are no connections within the layer, but only between the two different layers. And then based on this network structure, we can introduce the network energy, which is just the negative sum over all connecting weights multiplied with the neuron states they are connected to. And then from this network energy, we can introduce a Boltzmann distribution underlying the neuron configurations, which is just the exponential of the negative network energy. And if we marginalize this over the hidden neuron configurations, so we just sum over all possible configurations of hidden neurons, then this gives us just the probability distribution underlying the visible neuron configurations only. And this is what we are interested in, because the visible neurons are the ones that we want to interpret and that we can read out. So we can generate samples of visible neuron configurations following this distribution. And we can do this efficiently, and we can also train our restricted Bolzmann machine efficiently to encode a target probability distribution. And of course, we have to normalize with our partition sum down there. Okay, and so now we can use these restricted Bolzmann machines to represent quantum states. So this was one of the initial approaches where restricted Bolzmann machines were used. And the idea here is that if we have just some quantum state, so just some configuration of qubits, then we can expand the state vector in terms of the basis states. So these phi states here are just all possible configurations of each qubit being up or down. And then each term gets weighted with this wave function amplitude, psi of phi, which is in general a complex number. And now we can, or if we want to represent this state vector, then we can do this by just finding all these wave function amplitudes. And once we know them, we have an expression for our state vector. So how can we find these wave function amplitudes? So it's a pretty simple approach is to look at expectation values of diagonal observables. So assume we have an observable with only elements on the diagonal of the matrix representation. Then we can evaluate this expectation value by, again, summing over all basis states. Then we evaluate our diagonal observable at each basis state. And we weight each term with this wave function amplitude squared. Now, the wave function amplitude squared is a real number. It's non-negative. And if we assume we normalize our wave function, also the squared wave function amplitude is normalized. And so we can interpret our squared wave function amplitude as a probability distribution. And so the first thing we can do now is we can rename our basis states. We can call them V. And then you can see that in this case, we just said, OK, we let each qubit correspond to one neuron or one visible neuron in our restricted Boltzmann machine. And then the squared wave function amplitude is just the probability distribution underlying the visible neurons in the restricted Boltzmann machine. So this way, we can encode this probability distribution in the RBM. And with this, we represent our quantum state using the restricted Boltzmann machine. So now we want to train our RBM such that we approximate this squared wave function amplitude. The only problem now is this only works really if our wave function amplitude is real valued, because if it is complex valued and we only look at the squared wave function amplitude, then we always lose the entire information about the complex phase. And so this is only an exact approach for very specific quantum states where the wave function amplitude is real valued. If this is not the case, there exist different ways how you can modify the network architecture. So you can either choose complex valued connecting parameters or weights or biases, or you can introduce another set of hidden neurons, which then helps you to, or which you can interpret as the complex phase. And there also exists another way where we actually don't need to modify the network architecture, but we can use these positive operator valued measures, or POVM representation of our qubits. We are now, instead of just measuring the qubit in the computational basis and seeing if it's up or down, we measure the qubit in four possible bases, and we choose a smart combination of bases, which actually lie on a tetrahedron in the Bloch sphere. And if we measure our qubit in these four bases, then we can look at the probability distribution of finding our qubit in each of these four states. And this probability distribution, this P of A, can uniquely be mapped to the density matrix. And so this way, we have a unique mapping between a probability distribution underlying these measurements in the four bases and the density matrix. And so if we can encode this probability distribution, we have a full representation of our density matrix, and we can encode this probability distribution in our restricted Boltzmann machine, because it's just a standard probability distribution. That's what RBMs are made for. Okay, and so today I want to focus on using this POVM representation in order to represent quantum states with the restricted Boltzmann machine. And now we have all the ingredients pretty much. So we only need to talk about how we train our network. So if we want to encode a quantum state in the RBM, so I always assume that we have some quantum experiment. I'm a theoretician, so I don't really care what is going on in there. I just know that we can set some input values, and then depending on these input values, the experiment just generates some or prepares some qubit state, and we can only access this qubit state via projective measurements. And so we can read out the qubit configuration of our state, and now reading it out once doesn't tell us anything because we are in quantum mechanics, so we have our superposition principle. And so to get any information about the prepared quantum state, we need to measure quite a lot of times. After each measurement, we have to re-prepare our state. But by measuring multiple times, we can generate such a measurement set. So we have a set of measurement outcomes of the same observable. And this set of measurement outcomes follows some probability distribution, which we call PD. And then we can train our restricted Boltzmann machine to approximate this probability distribution underlying our measurement set. And we do this by minimizing the so-called Kullback-Leibler divergence, which is kind of a distance measure between two probability distributions. And so if we minimize this when we train our network, then we bring our distribution encoded in the RBM close to the distribution underlying our measurement data set. And this is basically, if we assume we measure in a diagonal, or we measure in a diagonal observable, then this underlying probability distribution is just our wave function amplitude squared that I showed you before. And so this is how we train our network. And now we have pretty much all the ingredients. We know how to encode quantum states in RBMs. We have seen how we can train out the RBMs. And I showed you in the beginning that we can approximate RBMs with spiking neuromorphic hardware or spiking neurons in general. And so that's exactly what we did. So this was a project I did back at Heidelberg University in Germany, where I did my PhD. I did it together with these people up there and quite a lot of experimentalists who were involved. Andreas Baumbach was an essential part of the project. So he was working in this Viking neuromorphic hardware team, developing the hardware and helping me a lot to learn how to talk to the hardware. And so what we did is we used this neuromorphic chip, which was developed in Heidelberg, and we set it up so that it emulates a restricted Boltzmann machine. So we took all these neurons on the chip, and we interpreted some of the neurons, so the orange ones up there, as visible neurons. We interpreted some others as hidden neurons, and we chose the connections accordingly. So we set the connections between visible and hidden neurons to some weights, some random initial weights. We set the other connections between hidden neurons, just between two hidden neurons, or between two visible neurons to zero. And then we had our network set up. And then we trained our network, and we were reading out the neuron configurations at different points in time, just checking if our neuron is in the refractory state or not. And with this, we were able to generate such a histogram, and we could interpret this histogram in the POVM basis to represent some quantum state. And so we had everything set up, and then we said, okay, let's try some quantum state, and we decided to start very simple. So we just looked at the Bell state, which is a two-qubit state, and it's a strongly entangled state, so it's just the equal superposition of the up-up and the down-down state. And we were interested in seeing if we can represent that state at all, and then also if we can capture the entanglement present in the state. And so in order to check if we can capture the entanglement, we did this Bell measurement up there. So we basically sent each qubit to a different party. And then each party can perform randomly one of two possible measurements. And the bases in which the measurements can be performed are related via this angle theta. And then in the end, we compare the measurement outcomes. So we look at the correlations of the different measurement outcomes for different angles of theta. And based on this, we can introduce this Bell observable, which we call B here. And this is a really nice observable because, so first of all, it has an upper limit of 2 times square root of 2. And then it also has a classical limit of 2. So we know that as soon as our Bell observable is larger than 2, we have quantum entanglement in our state. And so this way, we can easily check if we capture the quantum entanglement on our neuromorphic hardware. And so this is exactly what we did. So we trained our network, and you can see in the inset how we train it. So we start randomly, and then we look at the Bell observable as a function of the training process. The black dashed line is the exact result that we expect. And you see that during the training, it really nicely converges towards the exact result. So it works really well. I was really happy with this result. And so all these data points are really me accessing the hardware and running the jobs on there. Now in the main plot, you see this Bell observable as a function of theta. You see again the black line, which is the exact solution. And you see the red data points, which are the neuromorphic hardware samples that we generated, evaluated in this Bell observable. And you see that it works really perfectly well. So we can definitely represent this Bell state. And you also see slightly that there are some gray regimes at the top and at the bottom. These are the quantum regimes where we go beyond this classical limit of 2. So there we really capture quantum entanglement in the state that we represent on the analog electronic hardware, which I found pretty amazing. So we really have quantum entanglement in our analog hardware. So this was a really nice result. We also showed that it works for noisy Bell states, as you can see in green. There we don't have entanglement anymore, but it still works really nicely. So it's really great. I really liked this result, and I was very excited. Now the next point is, well, okay, we can do this, but I mean, this is a two-qubit state, so we can also just do it with a restricted Boltzmann machine on our conventional computer. So what do we gain if we use our spiking neuromorphic hardware? And this is, the main point we gain is the runtime. And I'm, plotting this here. So if we look at the runtime, so first of all, if you look at the far left, we have to initialize our chip. So this is this blue part. We have to do this once every time we want to use our chip. So this takes maybe 3 or 4 seconds. And then you see the different training epochs. So training epoch means getting one weight update, right? And so each epoch takes about 2 seconds. And if we zoom into these epochs, then you see that we have two parts, basically. So in purple, we have calculating the weight update, which is done on an external computer. So we still have to get our information to an external computer to get the weight update for training the network. And then this red part is the actual exciting part. So this is where we sample our neuron configurations. And in this 1 second of this red part, we sampled about 125,000 neuron configurations, which is already quite a lot. But we were still pretty limited because the way the hardware was set up, it was a bit restrictive. Because apparently I had to run several sample runs because at some point I think the buffer one was full and I could not generate more samples anymore. So after 12 seconds, I always had to stop producing samples and then restart. And so this is why I needed 26 hardware runs to generate my samples. And if we zoom in into a single hardware run, which is the one here on the right, you can see we have some in and output parts. So this is where we communicate with the chip. We kind of give it the initial conditions, and then we read out the sample configurations. But the actual sampling part is the green one in the center, and this is like about 10 milliseconds. And in these 10 milliseconds, we were able to generate 5,000 samples. And I think this is pretty remarkable. Like, it's extremely fast. And then what is even more remarkable is that if we look at how this scales with the number of neurons we use, well, it doesn't scale at all. So if we use only one chip, we always have all the neurons on the chip running. So no matter how many neurons we use, we always can generate 5,000 samples in 10 milliseconds. And so this was really cool. If they optimize the hardware a bit more, then you can see that it really has a lot of potential of getting way faster if we can run the sampling process for longer than 12 seconds. And then what's also really nice is that we are really flexible with this hardware. So here on the right, we played around a bit with the network architecture. So on the top, we added some connections between the visible neurons just to have more direct correlations between the neurons. It didn't really change anything in the results, but it also didn't change anything in the runtime. So this was really nice. Then also, we were able to go to deeper network structures. So at the bottom, we have two hidden layers. Again, it didn't change much in the results, so it didn't help us for the Bell state too much, probably also because it was a very simple state. But again, it also didn't cause us any more computational runtime. So we could. So these are all the same runtimes, and we can really play around with this, and it doesn't change much. So this is, I think, the great potential of spiking neuromorphic hardware, that we can really generate a huge amount of samples. We are very flexible, and of course, we also consume a very small amount of energy only. So now we have looked at the Bell state, and we have seen that it's very promising what we have seen, or what we got out there. But the next step is to go beyond the Bell state. And so we looked at the Greenberger-Hornet-Seilinger state, which is just the generalization of the Bell state to larger qubit systems. So we have the all down, or the equal superposition of the all down and the all up state for more than two qubits. And we again trained our hardware to represent these states. And we looked at the fidelity as a function of the number of hidden neurons we use. And if we increase the number of hidden neurons, we increase the network expressivity. So we expect the fidelity to grow when we increase the number of hidden neurons. And this is pretty much what we see here. So in blue, we have n equal to 2. So this is, again, our Bell state. And we reach a nice fidelity for 20 and more hidden neurons. So that's what we had seen before. This is really nice. But as soon as we go to just 3 qubits in orange, you see that the fidelity is much worse. We still see that it increases if we increase the number of hidden neurons. But we don't really reach a very satisfying result. It's even worse if we go to 4 qubits. And the reason that we stopped here at slightly less than 60 hidden neurons is not that we were satisfied, but we were using all the neurons on the chip. And so let me get into a little more detail here. So we were definitely restricted, or the system sizes that we were able to represent were restricted strongly by the chip size. So on the chip, we have like 128 neurons that we can use. We have about 60, which we use as visible and hidden neurons. And then we have about 60 left. And all these remaining 60 neurons are our noise neurons. And so we really figured out that we need a lot of noise neurons to get a good stochastic behavior. And just to illustrate this a bit, so in this plot here in the center, we look at the spiking rate of a neuron as a function of the bias of the neuron. So basically, we look at individual neurons now, individual spiking neurons. We set all connections between them to 0, so they don't interact with each other. And this would mean if we don't have any noise, this would mean we have just a constant potential. And if we tune this bias, so if we increase this bias, this means we increase this potential. So we kind of can shift the potential up and down just by changing the bias of the neuron. And now, if we wouldn't have any noise, this would mean we would have a step function, because as long as our potential is below the threshold, the neuron would never spike. And as soon as we cross the threshold, it would just spike all the time, like as often as it can, given the refractory time. But now, if you want to really encode a probability distribution, we don't want a step function, but we want to have like a smooth sigmoid function. And this is what you see here. So these are all the different neurons, all the activation functions plotted there. And you see that we have introduced enough noise to really get a nice, smooth sigmoid behavior. But in order to get this, we needed 60 noise neurons. So we really needed to use half of the chip to just generate noise to get a really nice behavior. And so this was really limiting. And yeah, we can't really go to large qubit systems here, which is very unfortunate. And so the first step, or the the most straightforward step to reach the point where we can go to larger qubit systems would be to modify the neuromorphic hardware. Apparently, when I suggested this to the hardware developers, they were not too happy about that. And so I think we should instead, which is way more easier, to just look at the software or the software algorithm that we use. So now what we did is we took a restricted Boltzmann machine, which is a very well-known and very well-developed algorithm for our conventional computers, and we just forced it onto the spiking neuromorphic hardware, which has a totally different behavior. And yeah, I don't think this is like the right way to go. So if we have a hardware with a different behavior, then we should come up with an algorithm which really makes use of this different nature. And so, yeah, my future plan, or the plan for the near future, is to see if we can find more suitable algorithms which run on these spiking neuromorphic hardwares and which really make use of the spiking nature of the neurons to represent quantum states on the hardware. And yeah, with this, I'm pretty much at the end of my talk. So I have shown you that we can reconstruct quantum states from measurement data. So we always use numerically generated measurement data. Ideally, in the end, we want to use experimental data. We can then use our restricted Boltzmann machines and the positive operator valued measures to encode these quantum states in these artificial neural networks. And we can simulate our restricted Boltzmann machines with our spiking neuromorphic hardware. We can successfully represent our Bell state. I have shown you that it's extremely efficient, it's extremely fast, but it's also extremely limited. So our hardware implementations are still, the hardware limitations still restrict us to very small qubit systems, and the idea is to find more suitable algorithms here. And yeah, with this, I thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions?
Is this okay?
Yep.
Folks hear me? Okay. Thank you so much. This was a really interesting talk, and the results that you shared are, I think, are really exciting, kind of first with this new technology. I wanted to ask, as you covered that when you go to larger system sizes, the fidelity goes way down, is a future direction of this, are you hoping, like, is it possible that you might use this to try and perform Gaussian boson sampling to try and, so the neuromorphic chip is classical hardware,
yeah.
Right?
Right.
And a lot of these claims for quantum supremacy coming out of Google or Xanadu rely on their ability to generate this distribution that is classically hard to produce.
Mm-hmm.
But as you've mentioned, this chip is really good at producing distributions and simulating these quantum states. Is that within the realm of feasibility? If you can come up with better algorithms or better chips, that you could use this as a more efficient approach to Gaussian boson sampling?
That's a really good question. So first of all, I don't think that the chip is like super powerful in representing probability distributions. So I think it's similarly to artificial neural networks, which are good for some kind of distributions and struggle at some others, right? So sometimes you just need a lot of hidden neurons. I think you still have this limitation in the hardware. So I think the only benefit you get is that you can generate a lot of samples, but like really getting an accurate representation of the distribution is still a limit, I think.
Okay.
So this is still restricted. I actually have to admit I didn't think in the direction you're asking. So,
okay.
Yeah, but no problem. It sounds really interesting. Yeah.
Can I ask a small follow-up question? It was in your list of other applications you mentioned that this can be used for classification problems.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any sort of benefit in terms of the like savings in terms of the size of the training data sets that are needed in order for good classification to be performed?
So I think you really only get anything out if you look at time-dependent data.
Mm-hmm.
So you can definitely reduce like the data size if you, for example, instead of sending in every image of a video, you can only encode the changes in the pixels. So you only encode which kind of pixels are changing, and you only send in these changes instead of the full picture. And so you can reduce like the amount of information to the really only necessary amount. So this is what you can do. Apart from this, I don't think you can really reduce anything. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Maybe just a follow up from that first part of that question. Do you? I don't know, but can you compare the time that it takes for you to get a sample to D-Wave?
Oh, I can't. No.
We'll ask Semimol if he's ever here, but that'd be an interesting comparison.
It would be interesting to do that, yeah, but I haven't thought about it yet.
I was wondering with regards to like coming up with more suitable algorithms. I was thinking about Juan's talk yesterday, so could you use these neuromorphic chips to propose weights for binary neural networks?
I wouldn't know. Oh, I wouldn't see why not. So, but again, I didn't think in this direction yet because I just learned about this yesterday.
Okay.
But yeah, like generally, I would say you can do pretty much anything you can do with like artificial neural networks. So, probably pretty similar. Yeah.
Are these samples that you get uncorrelated or
That's a good point. They are not entirely uncorrelated. So it also depends on like how or which time you leave between the samples, because you have this refractory time, which definitely gives you some correlation. I think they are not completely uncorrelated, but also, so when I was running these experiments, I ran the chip for a few, like for a minute or something. And then I had a huge amount of samples, and I couldn't evaluate all these samples with my computer, so it took way too long. So I think it's way easier to just wait some time and generate uncorrelated samples. So it's like, yeah, the way you can like generate a lot of samples in a short amount of time, you can also just skip a lot of samples in between, right? Mm-hmm.
And so have you tried, for instance, encoding a glassy landscape in the weights of the...
No, I haven't tried around with this yet. No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the very nice talk. Yeah, I have a question regarding the mapping. So you mentioned that it's possible to map the architecture to an RBM. Mm-hmm. Would it be possible also to map like this spike in neurons to another neural network architecture, maybe a CNN or an RNN? Or is that still an open research question?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So I think you can kind of map it to a CNN. I haven't looked in this direction. I think what is really promising are RNNs, because you already have this natural recurrent behavior. So you already have like this memory effect in there. And I think like you don't want to copy or encode like an LSTM or a GRU in there, but you can just use the network itself as an RNN cell, I think. And so yeah, this is something I'm planning to explore. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So I've seen an interview with Jeff Hinton roughly 2 years ago, and he said actually one of the biggest questions for him in AI is finding an efficient learning algorithm for those spiking neural networks. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, has something been developed over the last few years to have something similar efficient as maybe backpropagation? And how do you train those networks?
Okay, yeah, so the way I train, so I will start with this, it's pretty close to contrastive divergence. So the standard training training algorithm for restricted Boltzmann machines. So it's you can really make use of the fact that you have the samples for the hidden neurons as well. So that you get them for free, right? So we slightly modified our training algorithm for this network architecture because we immediately get all the samples all the time. Usually, but we still had to run our weight update on an external computer. So we really read out all the samples, we transferred them to an external computer, got the weight update, and fed it back in to change the weights. They exist, I think not for these kinds of networks, but if you just do the classification with standard feed-forward neural networks, you can, so there are training algorithms which depend on the time between two spikes, which kind of tell you whether to increase a weight or decrease a weight, and so on. So there exist kind of algorithms that you can train only on the hardware. but just not for this case, I think.
Well, let's pause for an online question. Ningpin, do you want to unmute and try to ask your question?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Okay, so the question that was that I can actually hear myself, so that feels weird.
Sounds good here. Yeah. Just power through.
Okay, so when the question I put on the chat was actually before you mentioned you used about like measurements to state your like entanglement results. So my original question was, how do you choose your measurements to train your Boltzmann machine? Because you can choose different POAMs, right? So I thought maybe you want the information to be clear or nice, then you need to do maybe thick POAM.
Oh, wait, so the question is how I choose the POAM basis?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So, well, what I honestly did is I used Juan's paper who proposed this tetrahedral basis, but yeah, it's a Sig POAM basis. And so you need to make sure that it's informationally complete and I think also invertible so that you can evaluate your observables efficiently. And I think this tetrahedral basis was, yeah, it was Sig. It had all the ingredients and it was only four bases, which made it pretty easy. So yeah.
Like when you scale up like to more qubits, then like the measurements you need will grow really fast, right? Like if you're still doing the Sig POAM.
So if I go to more qubits, then like each individual qubit would be encoded in one of these tetrahedrons.
Mm-hmm.
So you have like one tetrahedron for each qubit, and then you can efficiently evaluate, or you can create your density matrix and evaluate observables.
The point is the measurement number that you need will grow really fast. Do you think we can do something like, depend on the structure of the problem you try to answer, maybe you can choose different like POAMs that's not maybe not information complete but more maybe sample efficient or something?
Oh, okay. I haven't thought in this direction yet. So. I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you.
When I'm looking at this plot, it seems like a large number of hidden neurons needed for a relatively small number of qubits. So if I had a classical RBM, would that be different?
Yeah, like with the classical RBM, you need way less hidden neurons. I mean, especially for like a two qubit state, it's really a huge amount of hidden neurons. The problem is still that you're only approximating an RBM. It's not an actual RBM. So, if your weights, for example, get too large or your biases get too large, then you run out of this approximation regime. And I think this is the reason why you just need more hidden neurons, because you don't really have an RBM, so you can't really compare these networks. This for some reason just requires more hidden neurons.
Sorry, quick question. Maybe how does the number of the noisy neurons scale with the system size? Do you also have to increase those?
I think no, because we calibrated all the neurons on the chip. So when I showed this plot about these sigmoid functions, we looked at all the neurons.
Okay.
So they are already all calibrated, and we only use like a small part of it if we have a smaller network.
Okay.
But as long as we stay on one chip, then we don't need more noise neurons.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, if that's it, we have a 15-minute break to get caffeinated. Back here at 10:30. Let's thank Steph again. Thank you very much.